All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Guiding Lights. And this is where we get to bend our brains a little bit with Bernadette Roberts as she explains awakening from her direct experience and often using language that is different than the language that we tend to use around here, which is where I think sometimes people misunderstand her. You know, I've heard a couple of comments since my last teaching, and I know that the teaching didn't sink in with a couple of people at least. So that's okay. We'll just keep going over it, And you know, it's really hard when you learn to think in one way, to learn to see, it's not totally differently. You know, it's kind of like seeing the same thing from a different angle. You know, it's as if we use my mouse here, it's as if we've learned to look at truth, you know, this way, right? And this is what we're used to seeing, and we can talk about what this is and what this is and what this is and what this is and what these are. And we all use the same terms, and she's shown us the exact same thing, but she's shown it from this point of view. And as a result, what happens sometimes in the brain is the brain tries really, really hard to make what she's saying fit into what I already know. And then what happens is what she's saying gets twisted a little bit. One of the things that I specifically remember that she talked about last week was the false self and the self that is not false. And the interesting thing is the self that she refers to that is not false, the self that is real, in our language, we have also always called the false self. But I think it's very, very important to listen to why she doesn't call it the false self, because she's making a very important discrimination between the two. That if we can hear that important discrimination, we'll have more clarity. So we call the false self, and this is because we learned this from Nisargadatta Maharaj, we call the false self the I am presence and I'm trying to find the right words because the words are just so hard. The I am presence and the personality, body, mind. I'll use those words. She is breaking it down into the personality, which she calls the false self, and the I am presence, which she calls the real self. And she doesn't mean the real self in the same way Nisargadatta or Ramana Maharshi does. But it's very important to hear why she says what she says. What she is saying is that when you are born, or some point after you're born, I'm not sure, sometime by the time you're two, you get a sense of me. A sense of I am. And that sense of me, that sense of I am, she says, is real to the human. Every human has that sense of me, that sense of I am, and that is what makes you human, that sense of self. Then what gets added on to that is as we learn things. You know, for example, we learn we're a bad little girl or a bad little boy or a good little girl or a good little boy or stupid or smart or whatever our parents teach us and our other caregivers. And we learn things from our culture. You know, we learn the way we think about God. You know, we learn the way we think about, even at a very young age, we don't know, but we're already starting to be politically indoctrinated. You know, for example, whether you're raised by liberals or whether you're raised by you know, rednecks out in the woods, you're going to be raised differently, right? And all of that that we learn from others, she calls the false self. But that sense of me, that sense of I am, that sense I exist, That is just what she refers to as consciousness. That is just being human. And she says that is very real. And again, she's using the words real differently than Nisargadatta Maharaj or Ramana Maharshi, because they would use the word real only to define that which is eternal. But she's distinguishing between this unblemished, natural sense of self that every human has, and the false ideas that get added on top later. For example, you know, Jasmine was adopted. She's from China. And if Jasmine had been raised by her birth parents, we all know she would be a completely different person than she is today, having been raised by me, right? We don't know how she would be different, but we know she would be different. But the sense of I am that Jasmine has, she would have whether she had been raised by her birth parents, raised in the orphanage, or raised by me. You see the difference? Just the sense of existing she would have in all three situations, even though she would have turned out to be a different person if she had been raised in each of those different three situations. So this is what Bernadette Roberts means when she talks about, at this point, the false self and the real self. And you can see that it's important even to us to understand that difference, because when we sit down to meditate, you know, Nisargadatta Maharaj, for example, is asking us to meditate on the I Am Presence, contemplate the I Am Presence. That means we're meditating on that which Bernadette is describing as the real self, that sense of me, that sense of I am, that sense of self that I would have even if I had been raised by completely different people in a completely different culture and none of this personality had been learned. I had a completely different learned personality. That me is the me that I want to contemplate when I'm in meditation. Now, another thing she started talking about at the end of last week was will. And that's what we're going to begin today. We're going to begin looking at what she was saying about will. This is also, I don't know that this is different than what we've ever talked about. It's more precise. More precise than what we've talked about before. I'm going to start at near the beginning of page 11. I'm looking in What is the Self? I'm going to start about two-thirds of the way through the last full paragraph on the page where it says, many people. She says, many people regard this mysterious center as the seat or origin of consciousness. And she's talking about, you know, when we finished reading the spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi and the Guiding Light, one of the last chapters was all about the heart. And Ramana Maharshi referred to the heart as the seat of consciousness, even though he also said in reality, the seat of consciousness is not located in the body. You know, he also said the heart is the seat of consciousness, not the head. And this is what she's really referring to here. Many people regard this mysterious center, seat, or origin of consciousness. While this is ultimately true as a matter of developmental priority and experience, however, we cannot say which came first, the knowing or the feeling self. These are basically two sides of the same coin. Which coin is the whole of consciousness? So my page just flipped. Fortunately, I said the page number out loud, which helps me to remember it. Let me turn my book upside down. The majority of the time that we've been studying Bernadette Roberts, we've been talking about the mind. Here's our mortgage. This is our mortgage, you guys, from the retreat house. We've been talking about the mind, how it's a reflexive mechanism, right? How the mind knows itself or consciousness knows itself. She calls this the knowing self, right? It's consciousness knowing consciousness, or mind knowing mind, or the sense of self knowing the sense of self. And we spent a lot of time talking about that. So you're at least somewhat familiar with this knowing self. When she talks about the heart or the seat of consciousness, she calls it the feeling self. And what she's saying is consciousness is not more the feeling self than the knowing self. And it's not more the knowing self than the feeling self. Both aspects make up consciousness. You wouldn't have consciousness without the reflexive mechanism of mind, and you wouldn't have consciousness without the seat of consciousness or the heart, which she calls the feeling self. But we're going to go a little deeper into looking at that feeling self today. She says that although it is not our intention to go into the various experiences that derive from the feeling center, such as energies, emotions, passions, and other subtle feelings, it is important to point out that the will is itself the deepest experience of the feeling self or the center of consciousness. The will. The will. Thus, in experience, the will is the experience of simple being. We are not always clear on the experience of will because as a volitional faculty, it can move in either of two directions, toward or away from something. So let me back up to NTI Romans chapter 2. NTI Romans chapter 2, of course, it's telling a story, but it says that the way this whole experience of the world began is when we had a desire. We wonder what it would be like if everything was different than it is. Remember? That is will. Right from the very beginning, there's a will. There's a desire. There's a wanting. Right? And so that will, she says, is the core of the feeling self, or the feeling part of consciousness, that will. Now, when that will is not moving, yeah, we'll pretend like my hand is the will, ignore my arm, just look at the hand. When the will is not moving, the will is the simple sense of existence. You could say in NTI Romans chapter 2, when we decided we wanted to create something different than what already was, we created an experience of existence that was somehow different than what true life is. And if you listen to my Tao Te Ching teaching from chapter 25 last week, you might have a heads up on this because we talked about the difference between consciousness as life and true life, which precedes consciousness. So we created consciousness, or we created this sense of existence that is different than true life. And when will is flat, what we experience is that sense of existence or that sense of being. But will in humans is seldom flat and still. Usually will is moving towards something I want, or will is moving away from something I don't want. And we've heard many masters talk about this, especially the Buddhist masters talk a lot about grasping and avoiding, right? And desire is really both. It's not really that you have desire is wanting, and then there's another word for the not wanting. Not wanting is also a desire. Wanting to avoid something is also a desire. So when the will is still, we're simply aware of existence. When the will is moving towards something as desire or away from something as anti-desire, you know, still desire but avoiding, then we aren't as aware of our sense of existence. We're more focused on the movement of will. So let me read that again now that that's been explained. It is important to point out that the will is itself the deepest experience of the feeling self or the center of consciousness. Thus, in experience, the will is the experience of simply being. We are not always clear on the experience of will or the experience of simple being, right? Because as a volitional faculty, It can move in either of two directions, toward or away from something. This movement is actually the experience of desire, which is a movement of the will, but not the will in its most profound, immovable state. In other words, the will is simple energy or being, while its movement in either direction is desire. So if we take this one word, will, this one thing, will, when it's still, it's referred to as simply being. And when it's moving either towards something or away from something, it's desire. But in both cases, it's will. Now, I will tell you, I have really contemplated the fact that she calls being or existence will. We know through other teachings that we're contemplating, through other very advanced teachings like Nisargadatta Maharaj and even in the Tao, the Four Principles of God, we know that there is an experience of death, which is actually awakening. So as I really contemplate the fact that the sense of being is will, that the sense of existence is will, I'm able to see that the sense of being that we just take as life is actually a created or manufactured experience. And it's not the true life or the genuine life that existed prior to the creation of this experience that we call life, this feeling that we call life. And it's really interesting when I lead these retreats at the retreat house, because I often ask people, you know, what is the I am presence, or, you know, what is being? And people often answer energy. But if you pay any attention to energy, that feeling of being alive, that energy feeling, and she's using the word energy too, you can tell that it's still a thing. You can see that with awareness. You're able to be aware of that energy. That energy is a very, very subtle thing, but it's still a thing. It still falls into the realm of created rather than the realm of source. And you can also, you know, I've also contemplated, you know, we talk about the will to live, you know, and I think we know that until we're ready, most of us will do just about anything to stay alive. So if you really look at that, you can see how life is a desire. It is a will. It's not just natural. Does that make sense? It's something we feel we have to protect. It's something we even usually feel that we possess. So it's still an overlay on top of what's natural. And when people talk about ego death or mind death, they're not just talking about letting go of thoughts. They're talking about letting go of what we think of as existence. And again, Dr. David Hawkins was very, very clear about this. You know, when he talked about going through the final doorway, he said he had surrendered everything, you know, everything he surrendered. And he looked to see what else he could surrender. And the only thing that remained was life itself. And he talks about, you know, giving life itself to God, right, in a very devotional way. And then he talks about that fear that came up. Can you imagine the fear if you're giving away what you are attached to as the sense of life? And yet we know that people who have walked through that final doorway, there hasn't been an actual physical death. Although they describe their experiences after going through the doorway as being dramatically different and can't even really be explained in human terms. So it's interesting to contemplate what we perceive as life as will versus just natural. Let me go ahead and see what else she says. She says, if all movement of the will were to cease as in a desireless state, the will would nevertheless remain as the simple experience of being. She says, self can either surrender its life and being to the divine from which it arises, or it can keep it solely for itself. Though we are not free to choose existence, it's too late for that, she says. Though we are not free to choose existence, it's too late for that. How we are to be in this world is our choice. So what she's saying is, as long as this will to exist continues, we have two choices. One choice is to live for the ego self, to live for I. And the other choice is to live for God, to live a completely surrendered life. And in that way, our life is not our own. Can you hear how we're giving up will by making that decision? Can you see how that's a step towards awakening, giving up will? We either cling to will by living the way I want, or we begin to let go of will by surrendering to God, surrendering to the divine, and living the way it guides, the way it wants, without a desire for myself. So if you understand that will is the core of the feeling part of consciousness, then you understand why abandoning personal will is a strong movement in the direction of truth. And so it's interesting to reflect, each of us individually, on how much we still live for ourselves. How much are we still driven by will, rather than by the relinquishment of will? And of course, we have Jesus at the Garden of Gethsemane, right, in those moments just before he was arrested, saying, "But not my will, thy will." Right? At first he's saying, "Can't you take this cup from me?" That was still my will. "Can't you take this cup from me? Can't you make all of this that's about to happen go away?" Right, that's my will. And then he says, "Not my will, thy will." A relinquishment of will. So self can either surrender its life and being to the divine from which it arises, or it can keep it solely for itself. Though we are not free to choose existence, it is too late for that. How we are to be in this world is our choice. The human passage might be compared to a moving sidewalk that is carrying man to his ultimate destiny. The choice is either to tune in and go with this movement or to spend our lives going against it. Either way, we cannot get off or stop the movement because the passage takes its own course and will be completed whether we wish to go with it or not. Thus, the quality of life is our choice, but not life itself. The will, as it exists primarily for itself, is the ego. So it seems here she's really talking about the script, right? The script each human story is playing out. And in fact, there's a story in her autobiography, which I don't remember the details of, but I remember she had this experience as a young child. She was probably seven-ish. I don't remember how, you know, she was a child, somewhere between 7 and 9, I would say. And she had this experience where she suddenly knew without a doubt that her life was not hers. She could kick and scream and resist the life that was going to be lived as her life, or she could just surrender to it. And it seems like I remember, and this could be wrong, because you know you have your own thoughts while you're reading too, but it seems like I remember her saying that at first she felt kind of ripped off when she had this realization. You know, she kind of felt ripped off that she didn't really get to choose her own life. I think that as humans, we like to think we're in control of our life. But if each and every one of us looks back on our life, honestly, there were so many things that happened that led us in the direction that we've come in. We weren't actually in control anyway. That might be another fun reflection. It might be fun to kind of take a few hours to sit down alone and start recalling your life. What are the things that happened that you did not choose that helped to propel you in this direction? You know, and start noticing how life was kind of just running on its own track. And you could either resist those things or you could accept it as it is. And if you accept it as it is, you feel much better about it, we all know. And if you resist it, you feel much worse about it. But either way, life is propelling you in a certain direction. You know, just off the top of my head, I'm looking at Sean and I'm thinking about paradise burning down. You know, she could have had a personal desire to stay in Paradise, California, but that wasn't going to happen, as well as everybody else in Paradise, California, right? So what are the things in your life that have propelled you in a direction and you either resist it, complain about it, be upset about it, or you accept it? And that when we accept it, she's calling that our quality of life. We can choose quality of life. We can choose to be happy. But wherever this life is going, she says, this life is going. And that we have no choice about. So will then, you know, the desire to get something or to avoid something really just turns out being more a matter of how much we suffer or don't suffer. You know, if I'm constantly wanting something I don't have, I'm going to suffer. Or if I constantly want to avoid something that's, you know, coming at me, I'm going to suffer. But if I'm able to settle that will down into its most basic way of being, which is being, and just be with wherever this life is going, and go on this life like I'm on a moving sidewalk and I trust where the moving sidewalk is going, right? Then I'm going to have quality of life while this plays out. You can see it takes all of the struggle out of it. And at the same time, it's another way of reducing will or relinquishing will. Right? Just like surrendering what am I to do now is a way of reducing will, surrendering and accepting what is, both are types of surrender, is a reduction of personal will. So in both types of surrender, what I am doing is relinquishing will, which is going to take me down to the core of that seat of consciousness, which is just the will to be, just the will to exist. And somehow I know that the core of that seat of consciousness is where the doorway is that you slip through. You know, like you have to get down to the core before you can find the doorway. You can't find the doorway out here, messing around with I want, I don't want, I resist. right? You have to get down to the core, which is just the sense of being. And that's where you find the doorway. So again, two types of surrender. Surrendering, you know, what I'll live my life the way you want me to. What would you have me do now? And also just surrendering, accepting everything as it is, the loving all method, both of which reduce the outer will, which is called desire, take us down to the most basic level of will, which is just being. And that's where we find the doorway to slip into reality. And that's it for today. Thanks, y'all. Bye.